This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 25th of April. Joe Biden confirms that he's running again for US president, setting up a likely rematch against Donald Trump. Scientists sound the alarm as sea temperatures hit a record high. And despite some gunfire, the three-day ceasefire in Sudan appears to be largely holding. Also in the podcast, South Korea welcomes a massive investment by Netflix. And we could have had it all. With help from Adele, US late-night TV star James Corden bows out from carpool karaoke. By the age of 80, many people have long since settled into retirement, enjoying hobbies, a spot of travel, or just spending time with loved ones. But Joe Biden, already the oldest president in US history, is instead gearing up for another grueling election campaign. He launched his 2024 re-election bid a couple of hours ago with a highly produced video.
When I ran for president 4 years ago, I said we're in a battle for the soul of America, and we still are. The question we're facing is whether in the years ahead we have more freedom or less freedom, more rights or fewer. I know what I want the answer to be, and I think you do too. This is not a time to be complacent. That's why I'm running for re-election.
So what does the video tell us about how Mr. Biden will campaign? I asked our correspondent in Washington, Nomia Iqbal.
He's basically saying he's the guy to finish the job. It was interesting, the video, he started with the word freedom. He confirmed he and Vice President Kamala Harris would be seeking 4 more years in office. He warned the soul of the nation was at stake, and he's repeated that warning. And I guess you could argue that a lot has happened for him to now say to Americans, well, that warning was correct, and I'm still the guy to finish the job. He made a direct attack on MAGA extremists. These are members of the Republican Party who are to the far right of it, using clips from January the 6th, Capitol riots, to make that point. It's worth remembering that he's not really done much himself to heal political divisions. And I'm sure there will be lots of criticisms of that video, certainly by members of the Republican Party. But 2 years in, he's achieved pretty big legislative accomplishments. He's built this world alliance against Russia following its Ukraine invasion. So I guess his pitch to the American people is, I've been doing a good job and keep me in for another 4 years.
But even Democrats weren't that keen on him running again. However, now he's announced, I guess they'll, fall in behind him?
It's really hard to know who else will really be the challenger to him. There are two others running, Marianne Williamson and Robert Kennedy Jr., who were seen as real long shot bids. And publicly, Democrats do believe that he is the man to certainly beat Donald Trump, if that's who he will face. But yeah, there are concerns about his age, and there are polls that consistently show that the American public is worried about his age. If he does secure a second term and he completes it when he leaves the White House, he'll be 86. Ronald Reagan left when he was 77, and he was seen as pushing it. But Biden has been asked that about his age, and he's always said it's fair enough for people to question his age, his abilities, but he's also said the only thing he could really respond to that is just watch me. So he clearly thinks he's still up for the job, and he's hoping that Americans will get on board.
And yet it's likely to set up another contest against Donald Trump that most Americans say they're not at all keen on.
I know. It looks like it's going to be a rematch. Rematches can be thrilling, I guess, if you think about boxing, for example. But I don't know. Having covered the 2020 presidential election, it was a pretty bitter, nasty race. And again, there are polls that suggest Americans just do not want that to happen. But Donald Trump is likely to be the Republican presidential nomination. He is by far the favourite so far.
Nomia Iqbal on the prospect of Trump v. Biden, round two. Climate scientists have long warned of the dangers of the oceans heating up. Higher sea levels, more extreme weather, and threats to marine life. Now they are sounding the alarm as the global sea surface temperature hits a new record high. Researchers say the seas have never warmed this much this quickly. Lucy Hocking asked our environment correspondent Matt McGrath for his assessment.
We've warmed more in the past 15 years than in the previous 45, and most of that heat has gone into the oceans, it's gone into the seas, and that basically has acted as a kind of a break on warming around the world. But I think scientists are worried now that that break may be slipping. We've seen record high temperatures in the oceans in March and in April. For the past 36 or 38 days, they've been almost a record every day, and it's significantly higher than they have been in the past, and they're worried that because of that heat that's already there, we may have an upcoming El Nino weather event this summer that could send global temperatures quite high by this time next year.
Tell us more about the El Nino weather event. Is it definitely going to happen? How can they predict that? Does it happen every year? And what would it mean if we get one?
Yeah, the El Nino is a naturally occurring event. It happens every 5 to 7 years normally. It means essentially it sees an upwelling of hot water coming up in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Peru, and that has a global impact on weather everywhere. Now, in the last 3 years, we've been in a cold phase of this particular oscillation called La Nina. This year, the expectation is that there will be an El Nino event. Scientists in Australia and other bureaus of meteorology around the world have been predicting it. They could be wrong. They got it wrong in 2014. It's possible they could get it wrong again this year. But if they're not wrong and there is a strong El Nino this year, that will add significantly to heat in the atmosphere. We'll see this upwelling of hot water in the Pacific, and that will add to the already warm situation in the world. And the worry is that we could see extreme weather events around the world enhanced. We could see damage to the corals, and we could see a record global temperature by this time next year, which I think people would be very concerned about.
Yeah, that is a really worrying picture when you describe it, Matt. What can be done?
Yeah, scientists were a bit glum when I spoke to them about this. Many of them didn't want to go on the record. I think that's a worrying trend. The hope here, in some respects, is that we are seeing a natural coincidence happening in an El Nino with a very high sea and a very high heat in the oceans. If over the period of the next couple of years, one of those, the natural variability, drops off a bit, we may have less records than we are likely to see at the moment. The sense of hope here is that nature does us a favour, but it's in the hands of politicians to deal with the issue of human-made emissions that are driving up water.
Matt McGrath, our environment correspondent. Well, the warming atmosphere is also encouraging the spread of the mosquitoes that carry malaria, a disease that kills more than 600,000 people each year. That is according to a new report marking World Malaria Day from the Global Fund, the world's biggest financier of prevention and treatment programmes for malaria. The details from Imogen Folks.
Last year's floods in Pakistan created the perfect conditions for malaria-spreading mosquitoes to thrive. 1.6 million malaria cases have been reported in Pakistan since the floods, compared to 400,000 in the previous year. Rising temperatures mean malaria is also being recorded in higher altitude areas of Kenya and Ethiopia. In the Horn of Africa, the malaria-carrying mosquito, normally only present in Asia, has been found. At the same time, mosquitoes are becoming more resistant to insecticides, and the malaria parasite is increasingly resistant to the drugs used to treat it. Malaria kills a child every minute. The poorest countries in Africa have the most cases. The World Health Organization has already admitted that targets to reduce case numbers and mortality by 90% by 2030 will not be met. Now climate change may push those targets even further back.
Imogen Folks. Residents of the Sudanese capital Khartoum have been venturing out onto the streets for the first time in days after the warring armies there agreed a truce brokered by the US and Saudi Arabia. There has been some fighting, but the clashes haven't stopped thousands of desperate civilians gathering supplies or trying to evacuate. The UN has said that more than 250,000 people could flee into Chad or South Sudan. Meanwhile, the UK has begun evacuation flights for British citizens after being criticised for only getting diplomats out. At the same time, medical staff in Sudan say they are struggling to cope. Dr. Atia Abdallah Atia, Secretary General of the Sudanese Doctors' Union, is working at one of the few functioning hospitals outside Khartoum.
The situation is very, very bad. All the stock is running out, and the hospital also is suffering from lack of electricity and water, and at the same time, lack of fuel for generators.
Well, for more on the ceasefire in Sudan, I spoke to Beverly Ocheng from BBC Monitoring, who is in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
There's still uncertainty about whether this ceasefire that started overnight and supposed last 3 days will actually hold. There's already been such a poor precedent for previous ceasefires, one that was supposed to be 3 hours on the 16th of April. It was poorly communicated. There were two other ceasefires for 24 hours each, which collapsed within minutes of coming into place. And a ceasefire over the period of Eid, which was marking the end of Ramadan, failed to hold. Sudanese people are fleeing Khartoum en masse because this has been the epicenter of violence. There's still some reports this morning of gunfire near the presidential palace and the army headquarters, which are the two areas that the army and the RSF, the paramilitary force, have been contesting in this power struggle between the leaders, Hemeti and Burhan.
And those evacuations with foreign governments sending help will step up, no doubt, if this truce does hold.
Well, yes, I think the idea when the US was mediating this ceasefire was to ensure that foreign nationals are able to safely evacuate. Of course, the worry is now for Sudanese who are left behind in the country. Many of them are trying to make inroads towards Egypt or neighboring Chad or even South Sudan and Ethiopia. And they've received an influx of people through the eastern port city of Port Sudan has been quite significant in not just allowing air evacuations, but also by sea. Road traffic has been hampered by acts of criminality as well as continued fighting between the army and RSF. But there is hope that this 3-day period will allow for more foreign nationals to be able to leave and possibly humanitarian aid to come into the country. But evacuation has been chaotic itself, both because of the fighting, but also because of poor communication. There has been days of outages in telecom and also internet provision in the country. Diplomatic offices have also closed many of their embassies and consulates within Khartoum. So it's becoming increasingly difficult to be able to reach people to ensure that they're safely evacuated.
Beverly Ocheng monitoring events in Sudan from Nairobi. Netflix has announced it's spending $2.5 billion on film and TV production from South Korea over the next 4 years. Korean shows have been big hits on the streaming service, with dramas like Squid Game and reality TV like Physical 100. While in 2020, Parasite was the first non-English language movie to win Best Film at the Oscars. From Parasite, which showcased South Korean talent. Our Asia business reporter Monica Miller told me more about Netflix's big investment.
It is capitalizing on South Korea's moment in the spotlight. You know, it's just remarkable. In 2022, the company had said that more than 60% of its viewers were watching content from the country. I mean, $2.5 billion is an eye-watering number. What they plan to do is a host of many things, including creating Korean series, films, and unscripted shows. It's really been an interesting period for the country. Certainly K-pop has had its moment in the sun as well, and it is incredibly popular with bands traveling internationally in big markets like Europe and the United States. There's just something very relatable about it. The films in general tend to have a bit of gore to them at times, love stories. They make you laugh, cry. It's got a bit of everything involved. Audiences seem to respond to it.
Our Asia business reporter, Monica Miller. And still to come. The underwater fish sounds exciting oceanographers in Australia. According to a recent US intelligence assessment, around 80% of the men fighting in Ukraine for the Russian mercenary group Wagner have been recruited from prisons. But it's been claimed that one of Wagner's recent fighters was from a well-connected family. This is Nikolai Charles, back when he worked for Russia Today.
November the 14th marks yet another milestone for the Sochi 2014 organisers as the official Winter Games stores are opening their doors for business across Russia. Olympic merchandise have become...
But Nikolai Charles is probably better known as Nikolai Peskov, son of a top Kremlin official. With more details, here's Vitaly Shevchenko, Russia editor for BBC Monitoring, talking to James Kumarasamy.
It all started last week when Yevgeny Prigozhin, the founder, financier and leader of Wagner, said that, few people know, but Nikolai Peskov served as part of Wagner. And Nikolai Peskov is the son of Dmitry Peskov, who is President Putin's spokesman. So that's what makes it really, really interesting. To a lot of Russia watchers and a lot of Russians, this news will come as a huge surprise because Russia's high and mighty, they have been criticized for trying to recruit more people to go and fight in Ukraine while their own children were living the good life in the comforts of Moscow. So one of the popular trends of thought is that this could be a ploy to encourage Russians to sign up and join the army because Peskov's son has been fighting in Ukraine.
It's not any old army, though. As you say, it's Wagner. It's this private military group, the mercenaries, who have been doing a lot of the front-line fighting,
which is,
isn't it?
Still illegal under Russian law. And Dmitry Peskov, back in 2018, he was asked about Wagner, and he said, according to Russian law, private military companies do not exist.
And, of course, Prigozhin himself did not admit to being the head of Wagner until
September last year.
But now, not only is he proud of it, he is saying that the president's spokesman's son served for 6 months.
He said that he had been approached by Dmitry Peskov, who wanted to help his son join Wagner. And then Nikolai Peskov supposedly went to Luhansk region, which is a part occupied region in eastern Ukraine, where he supposedly served as a simple artilleryman. And according to Prigozhin, he did really, really well.
I advised him against going to the Ministry of Defense because he'd have just sat there in the HQ or been killed as cannon fodder. That's why I took him using forged documents which showed a different name.
That's what Prigozhin is saying. But how skeptical are people about this claim in Russia?
The lack of detail, the vagueness of this whole story makes a lot of people really skeptical.
And an important context for all this is that Nikolai Peskov himself was pranked not that long ago as to whether or not he might choose to serve in the army.
That is correct. Back in September last year, associates of Alexei Navalny, who is Russia's most prominent opposition figure and who is now in jail, they called Nikolai Peskov, pretending to be officers from an army recruitment office. And he sounded really unwilling to be conscripted and go and fight in Ukraine.
Naturally, I won't come at 10 in the morning tomorrow. If you know that I am Mr. Peskov, then you have to understand that it's not quite right for me to be there. I'll resolve this at a different level.
So as far as this potentially being used for propaganda purposes, is this about the leadership saying it is not just people from poorer areas, from ethnic minorities who are going to the front line? It is the sons of the creme de la creme, the top of the Kremlin.
A lot of studies have found that the number of Russians killed in Ukraine, a disproportionately high share of that number, come from remote and poorer areas such as Siberia. So this could be an effort to combat that perception.
Vitaly Shevchenko, Russia editor of BBC Monitoring. Three US Democratic politicians from Tennessee who provoked a Republican backlash by protesting in the state capitol have held talks with President Biden. They had joined a demonstration against gun violence just days after a school shooting in Nashville, Tennessee, where gun laws have been relaxed in recent years. Two of the politicians, both young black men, were temporarily expelled from office for demonstrating, Justin Jones and Justin Pearson. After visiting the White House, they spoke to the BBC's Sumi Somaskanda.
We came not on behalf of ourselves, but on behalf of the people of our state, the majority of whom support common sense gun laws.
And we talked a lot about this being a movement. Not just a moment in time, but a movement of people, especially young people in Tennessee and across our country, who are demanding that legislators and people in elected positions do something. Mm-hmm. And that is do something out of the ordinary, but it is to do something that over 70% of Americans agree with. Make sure there are assault weapons ban. Make sure that there are ground protections. Make sure there are red flag laws. And even in places like Tennessee, more conservative states, we're seeing that people power movement of young people help create change.
Now, Justin, I understand that you wanted to ask the president to make gun violence a public health emergency. Is that something you asked for, and is that something the president's going to do?
So we lifted up that as an issue because we've had more mass shootings in America than days, and this is a uniquely American problem. And so we have a president who we know was the sponsor of an assault weapons ban when he was in the U.S. Senate. You know, talked about how we have to use this moment to continue the momentum of a movement because it's a crisis we're facing in the United States that no other country is facing.
I mean, your governor is now going to hold a special legislative session on gun violence. I mean, what do you expect the legislature to actually pass when it comes to gun control?
Yeah. Well, I think it's significant that we have an NRA-endorsed governor supporting a special session on common sense gun laws. And it's because of people powers, because we as lawmakers lifted up the demands of our community and called for a special session to say that it would be immoral, it would be extreme for us to let this year pass and do nothing. And so we have a governor who's supportive of red flag laws, but we know that's not enough. We need to ban assault weapons. We know we need to have safe storage laws. This is a uniquely American problem to continue to have these mass shootings time and time again.
But have any of your Republican colleagues in the legislature shown any movement on this question?
There are Republicans who will and are supportive of what Governor Lee is seeking to do, and we believe that as more people show up all across our state, we'll be able to pass more just laws.
After being expelled, you're both back as temporary representatives. How have you been received by your Republican colleagues?
We're dealing with similar issues as before. We have an institution that's rooted in white supremacy, that's rooted in patriarchy and marginalization of people and voices. That has not significantly changed. And our work and our presence is to continue to resist that by being the voices of District 86 and District 52 in the best ways that we can.
And our colleagues are not our constituents. My district is one of the most multiracial districts in the state. And so we're there to advocate for our constituents, to fight for our constituents, to make sure that our children in our districts are not having to do active shooter drills when they should be able to be children and flourish and thrive.
Justin Jones and Justin Pearson talking to Sumi Somaskanda. For much of this year, Haiti has been rocked by gang violence, with hundreds killed. Now, 13 suspected gang members have been beaten and burnt to death by a mob after being stopped by police in the capital, Port-au-Prince. Haiti has been increasingly lawless since the assassination of President Moïse in 2021, with criminal gangs taking control of large areas, including an estimated 80% of the capital. Our America's reporter Mimi Swaby has been following the story.
A dozen heavily armed men were intercepted when they were on a minibus by police at Cape Verde. And these are suspected gang members. According to locals, they were en route to reinforce gang allies who have been terrorising the population in these neighbourhoods. So police stopped this minivan and made everyone get out, lie on the ground, and they went into the van. And at this point, locals took the matter into their own hands. They dragged these men away from police custody, beat them, stoned them, before throwing petrol-soaked tyres onto them, all under the eyes of the police, setting fire to more than a dozen people, some of whom were still alive. Pictures have surfaced on social media, some really harrowing photos of a crowd surrounding a pile of burning bodies with these flaming car tyres on top. And the Haitian National Police have confirmed that these detained gang suspects were, in their words, unfortunately lynched by members of the population. Insecurity, though, is nothing new, but it's now reached levels similar to countries at war, according to the United Nations, who released a report on Monday highlighting a surge in kidnappings and murders. From January to March this year, the number of reported kidnappings have soared by 63% to more than 630. And that's on top of hundreds of murders that are known. These clashes between gangs and police have become more frequent and more violent, also claiming many civilian lives. I mean, this is a country that has really descended into increasing lawlessness since the assassination of its president. People feel helpless. They have taken matters into their own hands because they don't trust the authorities to actually act. In October, the government asked the United Nations, as well as other international partners such as the US, France and Canada, to back a special multinational force to really help stop the gang violence. But this hasn't happened yet. People are still waiting. Last week, Kenya actually promised it would send a contingent of police officers to Haiti to help stabilise the country. Again, there are a lot of promises being made, but people have not seen any action.
Our America's reporter Mimi Swaby. A series of underwater sounds, including apparently fish who bay at the moon, have been recorded by oceanographers. Wow. Well, that was the sound of a grunter fish, also known as a tarrapon. The man behind the recording is Dr. Miles Parsons, a research scientist from the Australian Institute of Marine Science. He's also responsible for setting up the world's first library of underwater biological sounds. Rob Young asked him how the grunter fish makes that sound.
They have a gaseous bladder inside them called a swim bladder, which they typically use for buoyancy. But many species have been able to adapt to vibrate that swim bladder with purposely designed muscles to produce sound. Predominantly with fish, it's all to do with sex, much like humans, really. And you'll find with a lot of species, the males are producing a sound to attract a female. And the louder the noise they make, it gives information about their fitness and their size. So a lot of it is to do with spawning. There's also other reasons like territorial communication to do with finding food or investigating new places. So there's a number of reasons why they produce sound.
And we've got another fish sound here we're going to play. That just sounds like rain on water to me. Was that the sound of the fish?
I think it's the sound of a popping chorus, what we think is planktivorous fish feeding.
That is the sound of them eating, then?
We don't actually know. Whether or not it's the physical sound of them eating or the noise they make leading up to eating, I don't think that's really been identified.
Once you've heard the sounds of these different fish, what do you then do with it? What does it mean for us?
That really depends on what your interest is. So marine biologists will be looking to work out what the behaviours are that are associated with those sounds. What does it mean for their ecology? You can use them in terms of fisheries management because some of these fish are making these noise at specific habitats where they like to spawn, and they only make those noises when they're spawning or reproducing. So if you want to manage that aggregation or that group of fish that are spawning, then you can use these sounds to identify the time and space that they're doing it. And in certain circumstances, you can get a rough idea of how many fish are there.
Marine acoustic scientist Miles Parsons. 8 years ago, the British comedian James Corden filmed a duet with the singer Mariah Carey as the pair drove around Los Angeles. Carpool Karaoke was born. It became a mainstay of his Late Late Show on CBS and a viral hit on the internet. Paul McCartney, Lady Gaga, Harry Styles and Madonna are just a few of the artists who featured alongside Corden crooning in his car. Now, as the entertainer prepares to step down from his chat show, Carpool Karaoke has aired for the final time with Adele.
I'm actually not a brilliant makeup project. I'm actually not a brilliant driver. So
I know you're not a brilliant driver. I'm well aware of this.
I also can't sing without closing my eyes, so...
Oh, well, this is brilliant. This is going to be great.
And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Lewis Allsop and produced by Nikki Verrico. The editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.